So today is May 23rd,
I think that's
2007,
yes.
And this is Karen Brewster, and I'm here with Morton Wood, Woody, at his home in Seattle, Washington, for the Ginny Wood Life History Project. Thank you for allowing me to come visit.
Welcome.
We've been planning this for quite a while, and just to get us going here, why don't you, if you can do a little bit about who you are, and I mean, I know that you and Ginny were married for a while, and what years were you guys married?
Ginny and I were married, in 1950, I believe, for about 11 years, and that was when I was finishing up my forestry degree at the University of California in Berkeley, and during the summer worked up at the State Division of Forestry in summer before I graduated in Washington here. I'm in Deming, Washington, up on the way to Mount Baker. And we lived in Berkeley that last year. During that time, Ginny was teaching me to fly. She'd been a flight instructor for many years, and we went out to Buchanan Field out in Concord, back at the Berkeley Hills, and we were doing all the flight and instruction, and eventually bought a little Cessna 170, unusual plane. It had a metal body and a fabric wing. Noel Ween is the only other person I've known that had a plane like this. But anyway, I got the job with the National Park Service at McKinley Park for that summer. So we loaded all our possessions into the little airplane and took off and waddled up the air route up the Fraser River Canyon and on up to Fairbanks with that overloaded plane, which was sort of underpowered, but it had a lot of capacity for putting stuff in it. You weren't always able to get off the ground very well. It was sort of a ground-loving plane. But anyway, it got us up there, and we started work at McKinley Park. And I was working with Bill Nancarrow, who was the naturalist, and the first naturalist that the park ever had, I believe, 1951, I guess this was. And I was just a temporary ranger and doing odd jobs. And we lived there in a little cabin at park headquarters. After a year, though, working with the National Park Service as a ranger and a temporary ranger, later a ranger, I decided that it was too much like the military in that they can send you wherever they want you to go. But I had long ago fallen in love with McKinley Park. I wanted to live there. I didn't want to go to the Statue of Liberty or Mammoth Cave or Death Valley. So, and also at the same time, Ginny and I had both had the thought of finding some way to get people out into the park so they could enjoy it instead of just staying at the park hotel and spending their time at the bar. that's another story I'll go into a little more later. But in any case, I quit. And that fall of, the spring of 52, and I was sent down to Katmai National Monument for the summer. So I spent the summer there as a ranger. And Les Virick at that time was the Wonder Lake Ranger. He's stationed out there. One time we were all out there. We'd landed, I think, at Kantishna. And we were walking around, hiking in the country with Les, and we wandered up this little path. It wasn't really a path. It was up onto a bench above Moose Creek, just a little north of the park boundary. And here was this little pond there, and we thought, oh, this is a beautiful spot. I wonder if you can see the Alaska Range and Mount McKinley from here. It was pouring rain, as I remember. It was pretty overcast in any case. The next day, I think I had to leave for McKinley, so we asked Les Virick to send us a card or a letter and let us know, hike up there someday when it was clear and tell us what it looked like. And so later he did, and he was impressed with a beautiful view of the Alaska Range from this little pond and the few trees on this ridge right above Moose Creek, which is the site of Camp Denali today. Well, this was a pretty remote spot. It was three-quarters of a mile of a quite steep tundra-covered hillside to get up to this place from the road from the Moose Creek Bridge, where the highway, which is the nearest point connecting to the highway. It was about 2.5 miles, I believe, from Kantishna, the old mining town site, and the airstrip. But we were fascinated by this spot, and we think, why couldn't a person build some homestead this land and build some simple cabins, rustic accommodations, and bring people out to where they could enjoy the mountain and the park and see something of what the country was really like. Well, of course, Jeannie has always been the idea factory and with us. She was a dreamer. We had both hiked and traveled a bit in Europe with the youth hostels we'd stayed in, some of the refugees in the mountains, and we were impressed with the way the Europeans use their mountains this way. They get people out into the mountains, and we don't do that so much, especially in those days. So it was kind of an experiment, partly a dream, probably not very practical, but it fascinated us nonetheless. And so I remember how to get up to this little spot from the road. Well, there was an old miner named Bill Julian who still had a bulldozer down in Kantishna at the remains of the old mining camp. Bill Julian and Johnny Boucher were the only two remaining residents of the Kantishna mining camp. And Bill Julian was pretty hard to understand, but with gestures you could... I can't remember whether he was from Italy or from... Johnny Boucher was from Yugoslavia, and he had his own way of talking, but Bill Julian, he was something else. But he did. He agreed to bring his bulldozer up and try and scratch us out a road leading to this little pond up on the ridge, on the bench. And he did. And he went, and he just started zigzagging up this thing. Nobody ever surveyed it. It's an 18% grade. It's really steep, and he just scraped the tundra off and scratched this pond up until he got to a place, less than 100 yards below, maybe 75 yards below where the actual pond is, the actual site of camp. And there he saw there was a swamp. And he said, I'm not going to drive my bulldozer in there. He knew enough. He realized that he would get it stuck. now, some of this area was permafrost. Much of it was an exposed south slope, so it was dry, gravel underneath, so you didn't have to worry about permafrost. But when he reached this flat spot, which incidentally is the place where the garage and all the oil barrels and stuff is stored in for Camp Denali and where the buses park, that's the spot we had to build that road by hand from there on. And that was a chore. I don't know how much detail you want to go into about that, but Ginny and I had differing ideas about once. One of us, I think, thought we should pile more tundra into it, and others thought, no, we should scrape it out, let the sun melt the permafrost, and it definitely was permafrost there. In any case, when in fact, it's some of it shows on the movie that we took, a 16-millimeter movies of some of this operation, which Wally and Jerry still show at camp. But that area, we had a little Jeep, a little military-style Jeep, which we had bought in 1952, with a winch, a power takeoff winch. And the only way we could get up from this swampy area to the actual site of Camp Denali, where it is today, was by burying logs, called a dead man, in the ground about every 150 feet. You'd bury this crossways, and then you'd hitch your winch cable to that, and then the Jeep would be able to pull itself up through this quagmire of chopped up tundra. We hated to chop up the tundra like this, but it was the only way you could do it. If you moved around into a different path every time, pretty soon you'd end up with a total mess, which is, of course, what the cats do up in the Arctic a lot. And they really tear up the terrain. We preferred to tear up one little section really badly, open it up, let the sun hit it. We knew this would sink because when the permafrost melts, of course, it contracts and leaves you in a big ditch, which we tried to drain as much as we could. Eventually, we got down to gravel, and we were able to pull the Jeep up with a lot of, with our various tools and supplies that we needed for building camp. A lot of it we carried up on our back. I remember carrying a bunch of 2x4s with Celia, and we'd put them under our straps, 16-foot 2x4s. We'd put them under our pack straps in the front, and then the person in back would get the other end, put them under their arm and the pack straps, and you'd walk up the hill carrying these things, usually with stuff piled on top.
Oh, my goodness.
And we didn't think much of it. You had water in the little pond, which we carried with 5-gallon Blazo cans on a yoke. A yoke is just a shaped piece of wood that everybody carried water with in those days, with two balanced buckets, same way the Chinese have been doing for thousands of years, of course. And that worked fine. And we built our first little cabin there. It was called Discovery, right on the point. And the point of the ridge, I should say, where it dropped off steeply down to Moose Creek for several hundred feet. And this was the brow of a hill, was what it was, of a bench. The whole site of Camp Denali is on a bench on the side of a mountain. Well, we were exhausted, dead tired one night, must have gone to bed about later than midnight, maybe. The sun was still pretty bright, but I mean, it was still fairly light. And a plane came flying over, and it was Bob Rice with a passenger, and he dropped a note with a tied to a wrench or something, which we went and found in the tundra. Said, come down to Cantishna, pick up your first guests. So I remember, maybe Ginny's already told you about this, but I'll never forget that. So we all had to get out of this one little cabin, which we had finally completed, and put our sleeping bags out on the tundra, I guess, to accommodate the two people, I think, that that Bob Rice had brought in. One of them was a school teacher from Homer, I believe, or Anchorage. In fact, Les Virick knows these ladies that were our very first guests at Camp Denali. Well, that's the way camp started. And it was very primitive. We had little housekeeping. Oh, dear. Excuse me.
Okay. I think we're back.
Okay. Well, anyway, that was sort of the beginning of the whole Camp Denali experience. And we... Well, this was interesting because this would have been at the end of the summer, 52, and I realized rather belatedly, come to think of it, that we didn't have any place to live that winter, which was sort of bizarre. You'd think we would have thought of this a bit earlier, but we didn't. We were too engrossed in what we were doing. So I took the plane up to Fairbanks, and went to see my old friend Gordon Herod, who'd been in the 10th Mountain Division during World War II. He was a veteran of that outfit, as I was. And Gordon had succeeded in buying some acreage from old Judge Bunnell, who was the president of the university in those days. And Judge Bunnell was famous for never letting go of any piece of land. He owned a lot of land around there. But it was common knowledge, well, you couldn't buy any land from Judge Bunnell. He wouldn't do it. But Gordon Herod, being who he was, one day went into his office and says, Mr. Bunnell, I'd like to buy some land from you. And so he said, okay, where do you want it to be? He bought, I don't know how many acres of land just off Belaine Road. It wasn't Belaine Road then, of course. It was the trail to the ski cabin in those days. by Belaine Lake, just due north of the university, and on the south-facing slope of the hill that goes up to Goldstein. Well, Gordon bought some land there from him, and he started building himself a cabin. So I said, well, how about selling me some land of yours? You got more than you need. And he, okay, go find some place out there just as long as it's not too close. And then by the time we'd finished and the park road was about due to close up, which is early September, you can get snowed out. You can get, that road can close over Stony Pass and Highway Pass any time after the 1st of September in those days, because the road will get blocked by snow drifts, even though where we are at camp and where park headquarters is, which is 1,700 foot elevation, it's still summer. But that doesn't do you any good if you can't get through those drifts on Stony Hill.
Right.
Well, we managed to get the Jeep out and got that back up to Fairbanks on the train. And I started looking around to buy some logs. And we bought a bunch of logs that had been sawn on three sides. So they were sort of like square timbers, but rough on the outside, from a guy down the Salsha Slough area. And Les Virick and I built this little cabin up there, 16 by 16, the very first cabin I built up there, with a little loft. About 8 feet of it was a overhead loft for sleeping. And then we worked on this place, living in a 10 by 12 mountain tent. Oh, no, not again.
The story. Okay.
Okay.
You were
well,
building, you and Les put together this 16
yeah,
by 16.
What the foundation was really not very sophisticated. It consisted of a row of concrete blocks in a square. After you've cleared off the overgrowth on this. Now this land is all loess. It's just a glacial silt deposit. No rocks anywhere. So it's very easy to just carve a little place, lay down your rocks and put your sill logs down and start building, which is what we did. Putting these logs together was pretty primitive, and I didn't know much about building in those days. I really didn't have much common sense. As an example of that, I had a nice overhang on the roof of this building, almost 4 feet. But what did I use for roof joists? 2x4s. I mean, that's pretty ridiculous. I should have used 2x12s. That's what you would have used today. And then filled it all up with insulation, of course. But in those days, we were just pretty naive, really. And I was not knowledgeable about this. I had a forestry degree, and I'd never done any building before. Well, that little building held up fairly well for a number of years. Eventually, Romani, my daughter, and Carl remodeled it and made a pretty nice little house out of it. And so that's just now the sort of the core of this building that they have.
Yeah, so that original 16 by 16 that you built is now the middle cabin?
No, that's the bottom cabin, the one which is now a little house that Romani and Carl expanded and put in nicer windows. And then the middle cabin that Sam lived in, that happened later.
Okay.
Oh, this was just this. Well, as it turned out, I wasn't. There were, of course, still leaves on the trees in this September when we were building. And when the leaves fell off, we realized it was a little closer to Gordon Herod's house than we'd intended. But, oh, what the heck. It's nobody worried much about property lines in those days. You just wanted to get a place that would be habitable for the winter. Well, as I say, we were living in a 10 by 12 mountain tent there. And I remember in October, it started getting pretty cold at night. And when you'd wake up in the morning, you'd realize that your sleeping bag had sort of frozen to the wall of the tent because condensation happens and it's cold. And gee, maybe it's time we moved into this place. By that time, we had a floor, an actual wooden floor, and walls, and a couple of windows, and a roof. And that, we realized, is what a house is all about. And boy, when we moved into that simple, pathetic little log cabin, it was like a palace after the mountain tent. And I wish more people today could have an experience like this, because we get all out of proportion with our building of our homes. These monster homes people are building are totally unreasonable. Yeah. But that's another subject, and I don't want to digress onto that too much. But a house is about shelter. And we had dug a hole under this, under the center part of this house, hauled out the buckets of dirt, and enough so that we could put an old barrel stove down there. And I had a grill just inside the front door, which was which would allow heat from this barrel stove to come up into the house. And it worked beautifully. We'd climb down this little stairs into this earthen basement, which was nothing but a square hole in the ground with about a 3-foot wall all the way around to the foundation of the cabin so that it wouldn't collapse. Mm-hmm. But as I say, in this loose soil, you can carve whatever you want, and it'll stay there forever as long as water doesn't run over it. Mm-hmm. As long as you can keep that dry, it's what the caves in the Gobi Desert are made out of, mm-hmm. in China, that have been there for centuries. Well, then we had a barrel down there, a 50-gallon drum. And the way we got water was you had another barrel in the back of the Jeep, and you went to the power plant at the University of Alaska. They had a hose there, and you could fill your little barrel in your Jeep from that, and then you'd drive it home, and you would start a siphon, and you would siphon that barrel of water down into the barrel in the basement. Then we had a little pitcher pump, a little old-fashioned pitcher pump, a hand pump like you'd have in the farm, and we'd pump the water from the barrel in the basement up to the kitchen sink. It was worked fine. Mm-hmm. And you had a Blazo can underneath the sink, so that when that filled up, you wanted to be very aware of that.
Right.
So you could dump it before it overflowed.
Right.
That was our plumbing system. That and an outhouse and Coleman lamps and Aladdin lamps were your light. Wood stove was your heat. And it was perfectly adequate. In fact, as I say, it seemed palatial compared to a tent. Everything is relative in that respect. But, and it was, as I recall, it was several years before we ever got electricity out there in this area, which somehow picked up the name of Dog Patch. I think Celia gave it that name because there were a lot of dogs out there. Everybody had dogs, and so it became Dog Patch. It still is called that, I mm-hmm. believe.
Yep.
And
you said it wasn't really a road, Belaine Road, what is now Belaine Road. How did you get up? What was that like?
Well, that did become a road, but it was not surfaced or anything, and it was almost impassable sometimes in spring during breakup. In fact, I remember when Ginny was pregnant with Romney, 1956 is when Romney was born, I had to drive Ginny out to the car in the tractor. We had a little Oliver crawler tractor, and because you couldn't drive in during that particular time, which was breakup was the rest of the time you could. And of course in winter when it was frozen, we had sort of little dugout areas with poles over the top to keep a little bit of heat for your car, so you could keep the Jeep under some sort of cover in order to be able to start it. But you right. still had to drain the oil, of course, and bring the battery in, things like that.
But Belaine Road was a dog team trail or something that you just drove your Jeep on?
No, it had been, I guess it had been bulldozed as a road, because Gordon got out there. He drove there. I'm not sure whether it went over the top of the hill. I don't think it did. I think it ended right about there.
There wasn't a bridge across Gold Stream.
No, none of that. That gold stream was just wilderness. And yeah, we were at the end of the line. I mean, everybody would say, well, why would you want to go clear out there too far from everything? Well, it's not anymore.
Right. Well, but
that's
when
relative
you,
term.
When you selected it, why did you select that spot?
It was because I was able to buy the land from Gordon, and it was a south-facing slope, which is all important. It had been the old muskox reserve in the early days of the muskox experiment in the 20s. And so it had been cleared, and it was grown up with cottonwood, mostly, with some spruce interspersed. In the flatland, of course, it was spruce, but this is on the slope, so it was a little bit above the ice fog level, and that's all important. And you could look out over the valley from there. It wasn't very high, but it was high enough to escape the ice fog. And I don't think we even knew about ice fog in those days, but we learned later. But anyway, it was a nice area. And as I say, in those days, nobody ever thought about electricity or having a well or running water. You carried your water. Mm-hmm. And some people up in this area still do have to buy their water, as you know. Fred Reese, I think, still does. Right. But eventually we had a well there. And
so how long did you live in that 16 by 16 before you started building the current house?
I'm trying to think. 56, 57. Must have been several years. And eventually, Golden Valley Electric brought power out there, and they ran this power line through up above us on the hill. And it must have been about then that Les Virick bought his land a little farther out, and Bucky Wilson, who worked at the Geophysical Institute, bought his patch, which is a little higher on the hill, and then Bryna Kessel bought her land, and Celia decided to build a cabin on beyond where our houses were, which is now where Walt Benish and Renata live. And Bucky still has his, I think he still has his original little cabin, which he and I actually built our cabins about the same size time. He was pioneering then too. Bryna came along a little later and built a regular house, but...
Now, the house that Ginny currently lives in,
okay,
when
that was
that
my
built?
Wood shop. After building this first little cabin, then we built a somewhat larger 18 by 24 foot log, similar type of construction, farther to the east, through the trail, past Ginny's, what's now Ginny's garden, and where the chickens live. And that was my wood shop, because I liked doing woodworking and stuff. And this was before I started going back to the university to get a degree in languages, and that's what I really loved, and that's what I wanted to do. But this was the early part. I built this this wood shop, and that's what Ginny lives in today, except it's been extended uphill and also extended farther east. And 1 year I went up and we lifted that cabin up. We actually elevated it with jacks and the tractor, and we built a cement basement underneath it, a regular cement block basement with a slab floor. And Bernie Jill Keel, the German fellow, was helped us build this thing, and then we lowered it down, and so that was where the bathroom and Celia's apartment was underneath.
That's quite an operation.
And yes, but it wasn't too bad. Now, did we do that same thing eventually under the little cabin? I guess we did. Yeah, another year I went up and we did the same under the first little original cabin. Got a decent basement under that. I'd forgotten about that.
That's sort of backwards construction, isn't it?
Well, it is. You build a thing. But Fairbanks in those days was covered with buildings which people had started. They dig their basement, then they make their concrete wall around it, and then they put a temporary roof over that, which is actually going to be a floor for their house. Mm-hmm. And many times that's as far as they got.
Right.
Or their marriage broke up, or one thing or another happened. But many times then they'd go back eventually and finish the house up above, which is a much more logical way to do it. But somehow logic never got into our way. I don't know. I guess we were just in a hurry to get some shelter up.
Well, then why did you decide later you needed a basement?
Well, you obviously did. I mean, 16 by 16 is a pretty minimal cabin size.
Right.
And then also when Romney came along, we needed more space and eventually built the middle cabin, which was another story. But and also that primitive type of foundation is not good. We were in a spot which I hadn't really thought about very intelligently where I built that cabin, because it is on a slope so that when breakup happens in the spring, the water runs down. But were we on a little ridge where the water would have run off left and right and not gone into our basement? No, we were not.
No.
Well, I was sort of on a flat area. You know, when you think of the dumb things you do and that you did in the past without thinking about it, it would have been a much better place to build it, a little farther between where the original cabin was and where the wood shop was, which is kind of on a ridge. Mm-hmm. It's covered with cottonwoods, not very attractive. I like the spruce trees and the birch trees in front of us. And it would have been much smarter to have built there. Of course, we never would have had trouble with water running into the basements.
Right.
But we've always had that problem. So you end up building little berms and ditches and whatnot. But that's all part of hindsight, is what you realize later. Sometimes I've done things from an aesthetic point of view which were really not very practical. And actually, you can go right back to the building of Camp Denali in that respect. It was a very aesthetic spot. It's a beautiful spot. But from most people's point of view, they would say, well, why on earth? Bill Nancarrow is an example. Why do you ever want to build something way out there? He built his place in at Dinneaky Lakes, which was much more sensible, really. I mean, it was close, but it didn't have the inspirational value that that little pond and that ridge had for us. It was just something that somehow grabbed our spirits, I guess. And it was a magical place to me to watch the sun setting on the north side of Mount McKinley in the summer when that golden Alpenglow comes creeping up the mountainside. It was just very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's inspired people for many years, too. So what is practical? Who's to say? The world changes, and that's now not out at the end of everything, because they're even talking about other routes to get out to Kantishna, you know.
Right.
The railroads, increased roads, this and that. But in those days, it was pretty far out.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested in terms of the inspiration. You said, you know, you were had been in Europe and how that influenced you. But yeah, what motivated, why do a Camp Denali and work with visitors and things?
Well, I had tried a couple of different things. After my forestry degree, I didn't care about cutting trees and stuff. I got much more interested in the wilderness values, and the work in the park got me oriented in this direction. I tried learning civil engineering, going back to the University of Alaska, and it never caught on. Eventually, I realized I loved teaching. And the reason I knew this was because our real joy in building camp was in going back over this remarkable stretch of 90 miles of road back to headquarters, picking up our guests from the train. They'd flown up from the States and really didn't know what to expect. And we'd have these people in this old Jeep station wagon. First, later we had Travelall station wagons, which were a little more roomy. And we'd drive them out this 5-hour trip over the tundra, up over the mountains, down across the rivers to camp, all the time teaching them about this country that we were traveling through and which we loved. And we loved that park very dearly, the whole country. It meant so much to us. Every river, and all those, the wild animals which we would see going up over Sable Pass and Igloo, and it was a unique experience, an experience that not many people can say they've had. I suppose it's a little the way people feel that have been to Africa and seen the migrations there. The experience of watching the caribou migrate, for instance, shortly after July 1st, which used to happen every year, was the most deeply emotional experience I've ever had, I think. I will never forget. We used to, everybody'd be at camp, and somebody would come riding in the middle of the night, maybe, or 2 a.m, say, "Hey, the caribou are migrating," and people would get into any old kind of a vehicle they could, and we'd drive back to Stony Hill and or Highway Pass, and you'd watch these animals gathering from the snowfields up above, and they would just come down with their calves, and they'd start moving west along the route of the park highway. Then they'd go from Stony down onto the flats of Thoroughfare Pass and go by the Artisan Vista Center. And I'll never forget lying under a bush in the brush there on the way up the Toklat River up towards Highway Pass, and just lying there with a camera and listening and watching these animals as they would come past me, and you could hear their hoofs clicking, and you'd hear them snorting, and the little ones would be running along with them, and it was absolutely a deep emotional experience that few people have had, and it doesn't happen anymore. So I feel very rich and very blessed at having had experiences like this. And during those years that we were building camp, we didn't have a lot of time. We didn't have a lot of time to wander like Aidan Murray did and like a lot of the naturalists did when they would climb up onto the into the hills above the road and watch the sheep at Toklat and at Polychrome, because we were too busy mostly building camp or taking people through. But we did have still an intimacy with the country there and with that wildlife, which was a absolutely marvelous experience. And that's what I feel is, I'm so lucky to have shared that. And we could share that with our guests. We were able to get, I think, an interpretation. We could interpret the park in this way, which was really teaching. And then the folks would be out there at camp, and they'd have the experience of maybe watching some caribou actually walk right through camp by their cabin. Well, this is really something for somebody from Florida or New York that had never really had experiences like this. And I think that was the big part of our joy in building that place and why we persisted at it, because it was a short season, as everybody knows. In those days, you had from, approximately the early June, depending on the snow conditions, to early September, and that was it. Pretty short year for trying to make a financial business out of it, but it was more than that for us. And this is interesting because it ties in with Wally Cole. See, in those early days, Wally Cole was a baggage handler there at the Park Hotel, and I guess a bus driver. I think he used to drive the buses out. But somehow he'd come out to camp on a few times on his days off, And something about the place out there, and he shared our love of the park. He understood what we were trying to do. And that's why we were, again, so fortunate in finding Wally and Jerry finally when, after many years and after Ginny and I broke up, and Ginny and Celia ran that park, ran that camp together for, 1970, what was it, almost 10 years, I believe, before Wally, I don't know the dates exactly anymore, but before Wally and Jerry were able to buy the camp and continue with the same type of thing that we were doing, with the same type of interpretive work. We did more interpretation of that park, I think, than the naturalists ever did, because we had people for a longer time. We had them for 5 hours going out. It was an exhausting trip. We'd stop at East Fork or at Polychrome and have a picnic, supper, and then we'd continue for the rest of the trip out there to camp. And I guess it was infectious, a little bit infectious, our love for the park and our appreciation for it, and the inspiring, the size and the enormity of the expanses out there. It grows on you. Mm-hmm. And I think that mountain casts a spell on people. I know it did on me and other people too. They feel and they want to go back, and they kind of sense the grandeur of it, maybe, in some way. Maybe that's what I'm trying to explain. Yeah. It's a little hard to explain.
Yeah. Well, back to the sort of the details of running camp and how that partnership worked with the three of you.
That was interesting. Oh, my goodness. When I think, Honora Bucknell was one of our, I think she was only 15 or 16 years old then. Somehow she came out, and she was our, she was helping with the cooking. She was baking bread in this old tent cabin which we had, which we called Potlatch, and we had a kitchen set up there. It was pretty primitive, as I recall, but, well, you see, at first we never had any intention of serving meals there. This was what they called American Plan. And people, we rented these little housekeeping cabins. They each had a little Coleman stove. They had a Coleman stove, later a little gas stove, and a Yukon stove for heat, very small little tin stove with an oven in it. And the people would fix their own stuff and their own meals. We had a little primitive store there where they could buy some supplies if they needed them. And we never intended to sell gasoline, because we had to end up doing it because people would come out there and they'd be out of gas. So that was another thing we had to cope with. But that's a side issue. Eventually, we realized we did have to serve meals. And Liz Berry and Bill Berry, the wonderful wildlife artist, came up and lived with us, Bill doing his painting, his sketching in the park, and Liz, bless her heart, hard worker, wonderful person who would help with the cooking and taking care of the little cabins. We only had a couple of cabins in those days, remember? But we would serve these meals, which were many things like casserole dishes, and they were good. It was good, healthy food, but it was we didn't have fresh vegetables then, unless somebody flew to Fairbanks, and then they would come back with some ice cream and some fresh lettuce and things like that, maybe. But it was pretty basic stuff, because we would get a shipment once a year in spring from West Coast Grocery, I guess. They'd ship it up in the freight train, and we would go in with the old truck we had, load it from the freight car onto the truck, and that was our supplies for the summer, period, pretty much. And sure, occasionally people would go up to Fairbanks, and with the airplane you could get up. That was always an adventure, too. Somebody would fly to Fairbanks, and when you came back, you always brought ice cream, and the staff would all be out there lined across, like a flank across the ridge there, And you'd come in and you'd push the door open and of the plane. You'd fly as low as you could over camp and then push the ice cream, which would be wrapped up in a sleeping bag to keep it from melting, out of the door. And the kids would all race for it and grab it. And that was a big treasure. That was fun. I remember doing that so many times. And one time I did that, and I got too close to the cabin, and I guess the sleeping bag unrolled or something, and ended up fouled up in the wires that held the chimney for the lodge. This was after we had the log lodge built. Mm-hmm. And somebody had to climb up on the roof and untangle that. But camp was in a perfect spot for this because it was, as I say, on a sort of a saddle or a ridge. Mm-hmm. So you could fly in and just skim over the ground, and there was way drop off to Moose Creek on this side, way drop off to the other side, so you never had to worry about getting caught in a downdraft or anything. Mm. You could fly pretty low and slow and drop things out of the plane, which is always a fun thing to do. But meals were
simple. It seemed like with the running of camp that Celia was sort of the business.
She was.
Lady, and Ginny did the leading the trips and things. And so what did you do? What was
Ginny
your role?
Was the dreamer who came up with the ideas, and Celia and I were the ones who, in many cases, kind of put it into effect in a practical sense. I was good at the building and the planning of things, of getting material out there, finding ways to get it up the hill. Celia was excellent at doing she could keep records of things, keep records of expenses and costs and income. That was her strong point. She was organized. Neither Ginny nor I was organized, not well organized about anything. But actually, the three of us worked very well as a team, perhaps because our skills did complement each other, and we were able to do a lot of good stuff there. Those years were very, very productive, and in terms of actually building that place, getting it going, figuring out the physical problems and the logistics. We had, there was one year, which I will never forget, in which they had bad floods. This would have been in, I don't remember exactly, maybe 56 or 50, somewhere in there. There were a lot of floods. The park records will tell. Yeah. All the bridges washed out.
Yeah.
The East Fork Bridge was demolished. The Toklat Bridge, which is a long, kind of a causeway, much of it, except at the very eastern end where the river goes right up against the cliff, and it's the deep and fast and black water, that got wiped out. And we had guests we had to get out to camp. And I remember driving, how on earth did we do that? I remember driving a load of school teachers in the little Jeep station wagon, four-wheel drive station wagon, and I picked them up at the station, and we drove out. We forded the East Fork River. That was no problem because it was broken up into a lot of braided branches, mm-hmm. of streams, and you could pretty well figure out where there was going to be not the deepest water, where you'd be able to make it across. And up onto Polychrome Pass and then on down and into the Toklat. What do you do when you get to the Toklat? Here's this roaring river and no way to get across it. But I can remember driving down off the road onto the river bar and driving fairly far, probably maybe a quarter of a mile up along the braided branches of this stream. Finally, you eventually came to the main part of the river, and you had to guess whether you could make it or not. And I remember disconnecting the fan belt of the Jeep because it looked as though it would be too deep. And if the water gets up to a level, when you're fording a river, if the water gets to the level where the fan can hit it, it'll blow a spray back onto the engine and just kill your engine because the spark plugs are shorted out. So you it was simple in those simple cars in those days. You just release the generator strap and, okay, that disconnects the fan. But you still got to figure how to get across this river. And I remember driving into that water, pointing at an angle downstream, and get deeper and deeper, and finally the water is getting into the floorboards, and you realize you just hope and pray that engine keeps going. And it did. And we pulled out on the other side, and I can remember the feeling of relief. But what a crazy thing to do. I never should have done that. I could have been stranded there. God knows what would have happened in this brown water. You know, you can't see anything because it's glacial melt.
Right.
And it takes my breath away when I think about that. But then we were able to pick our way, hitch up the fan belt again, and pick your way across the smaller streams and come up on the other side and up on the highway pass, and there the road was just fine from then on. But whew, I will never forget that experience. Ginny one time had the little Jeep, and she was trying to cross the East Fork of the Toklat one time, and I mentioned that we had a winch on the front of that Jeep, and there was a construction worker with a bulldozer across the river, and I think he motioned to, Ginny would have to tell you, she'd remember it, but I can't remember whether the Jeep engine died or not, but she was hitched onto that. The guy in the bulldozer, I believe, had the cable, and she was able to get across that river, but we could have lost that car otherwise. Well, I don't think she would have tried it. That was a pretty deep and ferocious stream, really. But
well, I want to.
Those are all things that you remember.
Ask a question, take us back in time, because we didn't start this way, but that, you know, how you and Ginny met and what she was like.
Well,
back in those days.
Yeah. Ginny and I actually first met when she and Celia had just flown a couple of surplus airplanes from, I think it was Wickenburg, Arizona, up to a guy by the name of Gene Joyner, who'd bought them out in either Kotzebue or out on the Arctic coast somewhere. The military in those days had a lot of planes surplus from the war. They were practically giving them away. And Ginny had been teaching flying, I believe, at Kenmore Air Harbor here in Lake Washington. And the two of them teamed up. They'd known each other, I guess, slightly in the WASPs during the war, mm-hmm. during the pilot training program and ferrying the airplanes around for the Air Force, Air Corps. Anyway, they were flying an old L-5 Stinson and an L-5 and a Stinson, a gull-wing Stinson, I believe Celia had. One of them had a radio, and the other one had a compass, but they were not very well equipped.
Oh, no.
And they flew those planes up from Arizona to Fairbanks in December, when there was a very few daylight hours in which to fly. And that meant you had to warm up the plane, get the wing covers off, and get it able to fly, and fly as many hours as you could until it started getting dark and you had to land. Well, in those days, you flew up the Canadian Air Force route up through Fort Nelson, Fort St. John, Watson Lake, and so on. The Alaska Highway, this was in 1947. This, I think, was New Year's, so right around December of 46, that would have been. I was a student at the University of Alaska then, and I think we were skiing out at Birch Hill, which is a little hill out on Ladd Field, mm-hmm. I guess it was. And I ran into these gals, and they seemed like interesting people, and they'd done all this flying. I was probably intrigued by all of this, and Then later, let's see, they were in Sweden that winter. Ginny and Celia were both students in Stockholm. And I was a student at Grenoble in France because I was determined to relearn the French language, which I'd known as a child, very small, but had lost because my parents didn't keep it up. Neither of them was French speaking. But somehow I kept a love of the language or something. So I actually bicycled through Europe alone that summer. That was a lonely time. And I remember having a French dictionary in my little basket of my handlebars there and trying to figure out this language. Somehow we ran into each other. And
that
we,
would have been what year?
That would have been the 1947. Yeah, 47, because 46 I was at the University of California and left, 47, I believe. And then I stayed in Grenoble that winter, went to the university. But we hiked around a bit, went up to Wengen and in the Kleine Scheidegg in Switzerland, which was a fascinating, beautiful country in the Berner Oberland. And remember, we stayed in youth hostels there and hiked around and kind of bumming the way young people do.
Right.
Or did more of in those days, I think. And then, let's see, later I came back and started at the University of California again and continued my forestry course. And they went down to Mexico, I believe, and they were driving in an old Jeep down in Mexico. And I think we got together back up here in Seattle, off and on, but we would run into each other, but I think, I'm trying to remember now whether Ginny had already been up in Alaska, and I think with Chuck West, I think she was working for Ween Airlines, and I think Celia was too. Mm-hmm. And Chuck West had a thing called Golden North, which was a non-scheduled air service he had. Well, in those days, what they did was they wait until they had enough people gathered together to fill up one of those planes, and then they would fly to Seattle. It was called non-schedule. And, well, it wasn't very many years that was permitted. Of course, Pan American managed to put a stop to that because of obvious reasons that schedule airlines couldn't compete with something like that. And she had, in that first year, I believe, I may have my time a little mixed up here, but she and Celia and Chuck West had flown some school teachers that had come up to Fairbanks, and they said they wanted to see some Eskimos. Where are the Eskimos? Well, it's several hundred miles farther north, and it'll cost you blah, blah, blah number of dollars to get up there to the Arctic coast. You're still far from the Arctic coast when you're in Fairbanks. But people didn't realize that when they were in the States. Well, anyway, they wanted to go out there. So Ginny said, well, wait a minute. And she dashed around town, found Chuck West, and Chuck borrowed an old DC-3 from Ween Airlines, with the old bucket seats in it, just like the military. I think probably a surplus military plane. And they loaded those school teachers in and they flew them out to Kotzebue. And that was the very beginning of the Kotzebue Nome tourist circuit.
Right.
And there was no place for them to stay, so they stayed with various families out there. And people camped on the beach. And of course, there was 24-hour daylight out at Kotzebue, so nothing much went on a schedule such as we do down here in the lower 48. But the kids would be playing at 2 o'clock in the morning out on the beach. Somebody would be skinning a beluga or collecting water. The way they got water in Kotzebue in those days was that they'd get the ice floating down the Kobuk River, the ice blocks, and put them in 50-gallon drums. let the sun warm it up. That was their water supply.
Makes sense.
Quite different from what they have in Kotzebue today. But anyway.
So when did you first arrive in Fairbanks?
It was in the fall of 1946. I had gotten out of the Mountain Division in the end of the war in 45, and